local news, culture, and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the heat is on. Thursday's weather today, the same as yesterday. And the National Weather Service has extended the heat advisory to Friday at 8 o'clock as we head into the third consecutive day of temperatures at or above 90 degrees. Plus, a new New York State bill legislators are looking at to protect homeowners already seeing the cost of climate disasters in their monthly home insurance bills. We'll have the details. The Deepwater Literary Festival returns to Narrowsburg this weekend. We're a media partner every day this week. We're featuring authors and events. Today, two previews. The opening night with Curtis Zuniga of the Lenape Center and Crafting Memoir, speaking to two contemporary memoirists. Plus, the summer lineup at Harmony in the Woods in Hawley. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Israel's military says it's impossible to destroy Hamas. As NPR's Daniel Estrin reports, tensions are growing between the military and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu over the future of the war in Gaza.
Military spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari said in a local TV interview that the military is close to defeating Hamas's brigade in the city of Rafah, which Israel calls Hamas's last stronghold. But the military spokesman said Israel's political leadership must decide on a replacement for Hamas in Gaza. He said, this issue that you can destroy Hamas, make Hamas disappear, it's simply throwing sand in the eyes of the public. If we don't bring something else to Gaza in the end of the day, we will get Hamas. In response, Netanyahu's office said Israel's policy is to destroy Hamas's military and governing capacities. The exchange was portrayed in Israeli media as an example of a rift between the military and Netanyahu over the next stage of the war. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The four-day work week has gained a following in some office jobs, government, and even manufacturing. Now it's making headway in healthcare, as NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
Interest in the four-day work week surged after the pandemic as employers looked for new ways to recruit and retain workers. Now a handful of hospitals are trying it out with their nurse managers, who oversee all the bedside nurses on a unit and are accountable for patient care. Their turnover rates have been especially high.
We've seen that across the country. The pandemic was really, really crippling.
Barbara Cottrell is chief nursing officer at AtlantiCare, a hospital system in New Jersey that began giving their nurse managers the option of a four-day week last fall. Since then, Cottrell says no one has quit and there's been no backslide in care. Other hospitals, including Mount Sinai in New York City, have reported similar positive results. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
The Commerce Department reported a slump in home construction last month, and Pierre Scott Horsley has more.
Builders broke ground on fewer homes in May than they did the month before. Single-family housing starts dropped more than 5%. Building permits for future construction were also down. Mortgage rates, which are averaging close to 7%, have been a drag on the housing market. The Bank of England is holding interest rates steady for now, even though inflation in the UK has dropped to the bank's target of 2%. Like the Federal Reserve in the US, Bank of England policymakers are wary of cutting interest rates too quickly and rekindling inflation. China's central bank is also leaving interest rates unchanged. Stocks were lower overnight in Hong Kong and Shanghai, but slightly higher in Tokyo. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street's trading higher at this hour. The Dow is up 125 points, NASDAQ up 38, S&P 500 up 15 points above the 5,500 mark for the first time. Dutch leader Mark Rutte is set to become the next head of NATO after his competition dropped out of the race to replace Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. You're listening to NPR News. Health Ministry officials in India say more than 100 people have died due to heat stroke this year. Omkar Kandahar has more.
India's health ministry says it has recorded more than 100 deaths and 40,000 cases of heat stroke from March to mid-June. Several parts of North India experienced temperatures above 120 degrees for extended periods this year. India's local media has reported birds falling dead from the sky, demand for electricity at a record high, and forest fires raging in the Himalayas. On Wednesday, India's capital New Delhi recorded its highest ever minimum temperature at 95 degrees Fahrenheit, which is nearly 8 degrees above normal. There was some relief on Wednesday as parts of Delhi and neighboring cities received light rainfall. For NPR News, this is Omkar Khandekar in Mumbai.
The cost of buying a house continues to rise as millions of Americans struggle to find housing. A new survey found that nearly half of metro area buyers need to make more than $100,000 to afford a median-priced home in the U.S. That's according to the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies, which found median home sale prices last year were about five times the median household income. Housing experts say the massive housing shortage will take years to remedy because of high mortgage rates and the rising cost of land, materials, and labor to build multifamily homes. And on Wall Street, the Dow is up 100 points. The Nasdaq is up 40 points. The S&P 500 is up 14. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Amazon Business. From small business to big enterprise and everything in between, Amazon Business works to help simplify the supplies buying process. Learn more about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The National Weather Service has extended the heat advisory for our area. It now remains in effect until 8 p.m. tomorrow. We'll expect heat index values of 95 to 100 degrees throughout the Catskills in northeast Pennsylvania for another day today and tomorrow until 8. Currently 82 in Liberty with a real feel index of 93. Expect an afternoon thunderstorm perhaps this afternoon. Some storms might bring small hail and damaging winds. Please follow the same precautions you've been observing the last few days. Hot temperatures and humidity may cause heat illness to occur, and heat exhaustion can sneak up on you quickly. SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry professor Richard Ross Shaker says these high temperatures this week are not surprising, considering how climate change is impacting the region.
This is our new normal. We're seeing the temperatures increase at an increasing rate and more of those heat wave days. Also, because we had a mild winter overall and we already had kind of increased higher temperatures, this is just par for the course.
And again, a reminder to stay prepared, drink plenty of fluids, stay in an air-conditioned room, stay out of the sun, and check up on relatives and neighbors. Young children and pets should never be left unattended in vehicles under any circumstances. Take extra precautions if you work or spend time outside. When possible, reschedule strenuous activities to early morning or evening. Know the signs and symptoms of heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Wear lightweight and loose-fitting clothing when possible. Heat stroke is an emergency. If you find those symptoms or know someone that is having a heat stroke, call 911. There are cooling shelters around the region, often at your local public library. You can find a list of those on our website, wjffradio.org. Now, as climate change produces more extreme weather, insurers are losing money. In New York and across the country, insurers like Liberty Mutual, State Farm, and Allstate, among others, have stakes in both sides of the climate crisis. They've pared back coverage and hiked rates by more than 30% since 2019 to make up some of that lost money to homeowners. That's in large part because of the increasing frequency of storms and other extreme weather events, making damage to homes even costlier. Many of them are also investing customer premiums in oil and gas and underwriting fossil fuel projects. A new New York State bill that would prohibit insurers from supporting new fossil fuel projects and phase out existing ones is in Albany, undergoing some examination by legislators. The bill would also protect homeowners, preventing insurers from dropping customers after storms and requiring a year's notice for cancellations. New York Focus has been reporting on the details of the bill. New York Focus is the independent newsroom doing in-depth reporting on how the state really works, and Radio Catskill partners with them regularly, bringing you their investigative journalism. Jason Dole spoke with Colin Kinneborough, climate and environmental politics reporter for New York Focus.
Insurers are starting to realize that the climate impacts we've been talking about for all of these years are really starting to hit, and it's starting to put a major dent in their bottom lines, causing disasters big enough that basically there's more damage than they were prepared to pay for. So again, yeah, that's happening famously in states like California and Florida, where you have insurers pulling out of markets altogether, saying that it's just too expensive for them to insure homes there. It's also happening in parts of the Midwest, where you have all these dramatic storms the last few years. And it's starting to happen in New York as well, where you have in some parts of the state, particularly here downstate where I am, but really across the state, many more homes that are at risk of extreme weather damage and severe extreme weather damage than insurers are really prepared to cover, and specifically that those homeowners' policies will cover. So that's one of the main things driving this legislation.
And you open up the article about this legislation, which, it's called Could New York Force Insurance Companies to Drop Fossil Fuels? And you wrote it along with Julia Rock, who we've had on the program before. But you open up with the story of like a Queens family having, storm related damage that a major insurance company doesn't actually help them pay for due to a couple of technicalities. But their premium goes up. And this is all kind of the sort of bad insurance news related to climate change weather that you might expect. But then you land on this twist that really surprised me, which is as insurance companies are raising their premiums, in this case here, this company is actually investing some of its profits back into the fossil fuel industry. Is this common? And how did you find this out?
Yeah, it is actually pretty common. And it's not something that, we were the first to cover by any stretch. It's interesting. I think you've had sort of two stories about the insurance industry playing out in parallel, depending which one you're paying attention to. You have the one we were just talking about with the extreme weather and the cost going up. And then you have an increasingly vocal, if still kind of small group of climate activists who are saying, hey, hang on, all these big insurance companies are also deeply invested in the fossil fuel industry in a couple of ways. One of them is that, as you said, companies like, Liberty Mutual was one of the examples in this story, but it's definitely not the only one. They take the money that homeowners, for example, give them in premiums every month, and, they're sitting on a lot of that money for quite a long time, unless a disaster hits and, they need to pay that back out in claims. But basically they're sitting on huge amounts of money, which they invest into the markets. And, like many people, they invest a portion of that into fossil fuels. And that includes, some of the biggest companies, the Exxons and Chevrons and so on of the world. There's another part of this too, though, which also includes companies like Liberty Mutual, not to focus in on them too much, but they are a good example here, which is that they also underwrite fossil fuel projects directly. So if you're, say, an Exxon and you want to build a pipeline or an oil field or something somewhere, you need to get insurance for that project. So you're going to go to some of these big global insurers, and they're the ones who are going to provide that for you. And often it's a whole bunch of different companies that sign on to the same projects because there's just so much money involved and so much risk. So those are the two big ways that insurers are tied up in this industry. And what the legislators and the advocates who've been pushing for this bill told us is that they're really trying to tie that in with the climate impact that the insurers are also increasingly mixed up in.
Can you tell us a little bit about this proposed legislation, who's behind it and what are its chances?
So this is a new bill. It was just introduced at the end of the session. In the last 5-6 weeks of session, I guess. So it didn't pass, unsurprisingly, before the session ended. But it's on the table for the coming year or years. And so the sponsors are Brad Hoylman Siegel and Farah Souffrant Forrest, who are New York City-based lawmakers representing us up in Albany. And so there's a couple main things the bill is aiming to do on kind of both sides of this equation that we talked about, the fossil fuel side and the climate damages side. On the fossil fuel side, it's potentially like really ambitious because they're targeting every insurer who operates in every major insurer who operates in New York State and has a certain amount of business here, or has a certain amount of business in general, rather. And that includes pretty much all of the major insurance companies. And they're saying that those companies are going to have to stop underwriting new fossil fuel projects and kind of phase out and stop investing in more fossil fuel companies and begin to phase out the investments in fossil fuels that they already have. So that would be pretty major. I mean, if it were actually to pass in this form, you know, that could have an impact on fossil fuel production around the world. So that's one side of it. The other thing is they're trying to add some protections for homeowners who are facing the kinds of climate damages we talked about. Make sure that, you know, try to prevent the kind of thing that happened in California and Florida, where huge amounts of people were basically just dropped off the insurance rolls because these companies decided it was too risky and no longer profitable to insure them. The companies would be prevented from just dropping out of an area after a disaster. The state could basically come in and say, put a moratorium and say on cancellations, and say they have to stick around for now. And in general, they would have to give people at least a year's notice before canceling policies. So those are some of the kinds of protections. I think the strongest and most ambitious part of the bill, though, is definitely that fossil fuel side of it that we talked about.
The legislative session just ended recently in Albany. So where does that leave this bill? At what point of the process is this bill at right now?
Right. So the bill so far has just been introduced and it went straight into committee, which is the first stage of review for any bill. As you said, the legislative session ended at the beginning of this month. So there's not really going to be any action on this over the next few months. It's probably going to get picked up next year. What the sponsors were telling us is, you know, and I think this is a pretty standard formula, you know, that they were kind of introducing this to get things moving with the hope of passing it in the next, you know, year or couple of years. I mean, I think one of them pointed out to us, you know, even the simplest legislation rarely passes in a year. So this is kind of just a start for this. Yeah, we'll see if it gets any traction in the next session.
Right. And that'll be what we're watching for, you know, in the legislature. What kind of traction is it going to get in the public? That's what I'm wondering. So it's still early days for this bill, but has there been any reaction yet from the affected parties, from homeowners, from insurance companies?
What we've heard so far has been pretty limited. I did ask a couple of the major the trade groups for big insurers what they made of the bill, and they said, you know, basically we're just starting to look at it. So I imagine there will be opposition from some of the big insurers. I'm also curious to see if state regulators will say anything about it. They don't tend to comment on bills privately, but the state has made some effort already to require companies to basically disclose climate risks that they might face, insurers specifically. So they have issued some regulations on this in the past, and I'd really love to know what some of the state regulators who have worked on this think of the bill, although it's going to be hard to get them to comment publicly because they typically don't do that about pending bills.
Right. And again, you cover climate for New York Focus. I'm wondering, where does this fit into the bigger picture, the larger narrative of climate change, battling climate change, climate change goals that New York State has set for itself? Where does this potential legislation fit into that larger narrative of what New York's trying to do?
Sure. I think that's somewhat of a tricky question. I mean, we went back and forth a little bit while we were reporting the story on whether this really fits neatly into the state's existing climate law, or whether it fits into it at all. I mean, the climate law that we have that was passed in 2019 says every state agency has to comply with it, and, you know, basically help the state to meet these net zero targets. But it's a little bit unclear what that would mean for an agency like the Department of Financial Services, which regulates banks and insurance. But what I think the, you know, the sponsors and some of the groups behind this bill really emphasize to us is that if we don't stop burning fossil fuels, ultimately, not just in this country, but internationally, we're never going to, you know, stop climate disaster. And that's ultimately what this bill is about, even if it extends beyond the borders of New York State.
Right. And in some ways, New York's climate goals and existing laws, I mean, they affect the state, but there's this vision of let's do this to have an impact outside of our borders, maybe show the way for other states. If this goes through, this is something that could have big ramifications for how people are battling climate change altogether.
Absolutely. And you're right. The state has often touted itself as a national leader on climate, certainly. Just on the insurance question, I would also note that the European Union has made some of the moves that basically this bill is proposing that New York make in terms of forcing companies to scale back their investments and how much money basically they have tied up in fossil fuels. So that would include insurers. So it wouldn't necessarily be a first globally, but certainly in the U.S., this would be major if it happened. I mean, we haven't. This is the first bill of its kind to be introduced in the U.S. There was something in Connecticut, but it was about putting a fee on companies that have insurance companies that have money in fossil fuels, not banning it altogether. So, if any version of this were to pass, it could be pretty big.
Yeah, and let's just bring it back to the homeowners and, you know, those that need the insurance and what we're facing in terms of what you're calling like an insurance crisis. One of the things that you looked at in this article, if we could touch on here at the end, is just the notion that, you know, maybe insurance companies aren't ready for climate change related weather impacts, but also so are New York homeowners aren't necessarily adequately ready for this in terms of insurance. Can you just talk a little bit about that aspect?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of our main reference points here was a report that came out last fall from this research group, this think tank called First Street, which studies climate risk. And what they found, they did a national survey, was that about a third of homes nationwide are basically underinsured relative to the risk that they face from climate change. So if they did all this advanced modeling of extreme weather events and, you know, rain and wind and flooding and fires and all of that, and compared that to the insurance that people have, and they found that in about a third of cases, people's insurance really isn't enough to cover the risk they're facing, which means they're going to end up paying more out of pocket, right? And that's true for quite a bit of New York State. As I said, it's particularly true downstate, as you might expect, you know, here with the coast and all, and Suffolk County, the eastern half of Long Island, is, you know, the most exposed. But parts all over the state are. I mean, even you know, closer to your listening area, you know, it's at least 1 in 10 homes in most counties in the state. So this is a problem that really is statewide, even if it's more concentrated here downstate.
Colin, I want to thank you for going over all this with us. We've been talking to Colin Kinneborough, climate environmental politics reporter for New York Focus. And the article is at nysfocus.com and also up at Radio Catskills website, wjffradio.org. Colin, thank you again.
Thanks for having me. Always great speaking with you, Jason.
Okay, we'll take a break. And when we come back, the summer lineup at Harmony in the Woods. You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Thursdays at 9, it's Connect the Dots with me, David Christian. It's the freeform show where each song leads to the next by way of a musical connection. Think of it as a dive into music's liner notes, exploring the behind-the-scenes connections that show that the distance between genres and decades is often shorter than we think. That's Connect the Dots, Thursday nights at 9, here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This is Radio Chatskill. The outdoor amphitheater on Route 6, just east of Hawley, called Harmony in the Woods, grew out of a small space in the Hawley Silk Mill, where starting in 2011, talented artists and performers shared their musical passions with intimate audiences. Today, Harmony in the Woods hosts a roster of performers and genres ranging from a Simon and Garfunkel tribute to the String Queen, a powerhouse trio playing pop hits to classic works. Joining us with the details of this summer's performance schedule is Harmony in the Woods co-founder and promoter, Jill Carletti. Jill, good morning.
Good morning.
And I mentioned,
thanks for having me.
Of course, thanks for being here. And I mentioned in the introduction how the Harmony in the Woods space kind of grew organically out of this small space near the Hawley Silk Mill there in Pennsylvania off Route 6. Tell us about how it sort of developed there for you.
Yeah, so we did. We just started off doing small performances in the Hawley Silk Mill. Actually, we originally started in a real small space in the Silk Mill, and then the boiler room of the Hawley Silk Mill became available pretty quickly, and that space was much more conducive for having performances and, it was a larger capacity, and it was certainly it was a pretty cool space, too. So it was neat to have these performances there. And so how this really grew out, I feel like, was a little bit out of, we wanted to do, Henry Skyer and I both wanted to do something, wanted to have performing arts performances in the Silk Mill. Space was really still only, it's not that we could do theater, we couldn't do productions. What worked was showcase excellent music. And so we started off, basically just started looking for incredible talent in the region. We tried to differentiate ourselves from, local bars or anything that had live music, but we were trying to really showcase mostly original musicians who were touring and very serious about developing their artistry, and also offered something unique, something like a different, whether it was, that maybe they were in the genre of world music or jazz or classically influenced, or maybe it was again, or something, like bluegrass and rock still, but as long as it was, again, the real artistry, coming from it. So that's kind of really how we got started. One thing would lead to another. Performers would have a great time, and then learn of more performers from the next, and continue to grow into our performers and with audiences.
Yeah, I just want to let the listener know there's a little static on your line. So if you're listening, it's not your radio. It's a little static on this line we have with Jill, but that's all right. We'll muddle through here. The outdoor amphitheater, it is Harmony in the Woods, and your tagline is "Performance is in our nature." If you're looking online, you can see the photos, or if you've ever been to the venue, it's such a nice, lovely space there in the woods, and that's part of the experience and part of your mission, really, right?
Absolutely, yeah. We the performing arts is, I think anybody would feel, is an inherent part of our humanity, and being part of nature, we're all part of nature, and being set in that environment is kind of really speaks again to the core who we are, and our connection to the earth, and that's definitely a big part of of who we are, for sure.
Let's talk about the summer lineup. So, yeah, you've got a lot of great folks coming up, beginning, I guess, in July. Who do you have kicking off things? And give us some of the highlights of this summer.
Yeah, well, we have so many great shows coming up. A few that I'm very excited about. We have House of Hamel. We start with a Celtic folk rock band. They're just, we've had them before. They have three-part harmonies. They're absolutely... you know, there's really a very high energy show. It's a lot of fun that we kick off with them. We have, the Wade Preston band does, he's coming with his trio and he's doing Billy Joel tribute, and as well as his own original music. He's always, a crowd pleaser and a favorite, but I'm also super thrilled. Our very first time having this group, the Lao Tizer Band, of course, they were nominated as Jazz Group of the Year. Lao is bringing Elliot Yeaman, who was an American Idol finalist and has an incredible voice, and they're being and there's also a few. You know, an incredible bassist and amazing drum player. They're in the, you know, work of jazz, R&B, funk, and world music. And they're just this world, out of this world, good.
And then that's just in really, July. It looks like a few of the highlights in July, and it goes all the way. How long does the season go? How long do you guys, as long as it's warm and nice outside, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah, we go, we run from July 5th until September 7th is the final show of our summer, of our season. And there, so it's Fridays and Saturdays every weekend. And we also have a couple of Sundays. So we're doing it all the time.
Yeah. it's about to get really even more busy for you, at Harmony in the Woods. You can find the full lineup and ticket information at harmonyinthewoods.org. And that is over in Hawley. Jill Carletti is the co-founder and promoter of Harmony in the Woods, and she's joined us this morning. Thank you so much for joining us, Jill, and have a great summer.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Have a great summer.
All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, the Deepwater Literary Festival is starting tomorrow. And we'll speak to one of the people who originally his Lenape tribe was from this area. He's coming back to open the festival. And we'll tell you more after this break. This is Radio Chatskill.
People talk about polarization. But did you know most of us are in the hopeful majority, tired of political divisions and looking for a way out? That's why Radio Catskill and StoryCorps invite you to have a conversation with someone different and not so different than you. It's one small step where strangers get to know each other as people. Help bridge the divide, one conversation at a time. Sign up at wjffradio.org.
StoryCorps is one small step and the radio station helps are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Can two people with different political beliefs still have a meaningful conversation? I'm Ronald Kelson, and I'm working with Radio Catskill on StoryCorps' One Small Step, bringing strangers and our community together, one conversation at a time. We are having conversations in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania all year long, and you should be a part of it. Sign up now at wjffradio.org.
StoryCorps' One Small Step and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Deepwater Literary Festival returns to Narrowsburg tomorrow and runs through the weekend. Radio Catskill is a media partner, and all this week we've been featuring authors and events from the festival. Today, two previews of some events that are happening this weekend. First, Weaving Storytelling and Song. Curtis Zuniga of the Delaware Lenape Center will open this year's festival. I had a chance to speak to him about the importance of returning to the Lenape homeland.
My name is Curtis Zuniga, and I'm co-director of Lenape Center based in Manhattan. And I was invited by the Deepwater Literary Festival to be at the festival, which opens this Friday, June 21st. I'll be attending the opening session at 7 o'clock p.m. I've been asked to present a book that my organization, Lenape Center, published a couple of years ago with the Brooklyn Library, and the book is called Lenape Hoking, an anthology. Lenape Hoking is the name of the original homeland of the Lenape people, now known as the Delaware Indians. But the Lenape original homeland extended from the foothills of the Catskills Mountains all the way through New York City, all the way through Philadelphia, and emptying out into the Delaware Bay. So that original homeland, which preceded the coming of the Dutch, was our homeland for some 10,000 years. The selected readings in the Lenape Hoking Anthology will cover not just the history of forced removals after European contact, but other aspects of our people, our culture, our language, our arts, and our connection with the land, which we don't consider a commodity, but we consider it a living, breathing spirit, a kindred spirit. It's a worldview that we carried long before the Europeans showed up. And I will also be drawing some parallels with what's in the book with my current work with Lenape Center up in the Kingston area, where I am working with a farm that has provided space for me to grow ancestral varieties of the same crops that our ancestors grew 400, 500, even 800 years ago. So I have two varieties of corn, two varieties of squash, three varieties of beans. I've got about four varieties of sunflowers, gourds, tobacco, sweetgrass. These are all traditional plants in our culture, and in many cases, some of these seeds are being rematriated into the soil of our homeland for the first time in 400 years. So it's an exciting project for me.
Opening the Deepwater Literary Festival on Friday, are you feeling this is a return to the Lenape homeland and representing any act of reclamation of culture and heritage?
Yes, the opening session this Friday will be me telling that very story. We've been, our little organization, Lenape Center, which is made up of individuals who are members of the communities that have been pushed out into Oklahoma, into Wisconsin, into southern Ontario, Canada. That's my original homeland is Oklahoma. But I've been back now, beginning my third season at the farm, and therefore my third full-time season living in the homeland. And it is part of a return, a reclamation, but also an effort to inform and educate people about the original people of this land, and not to be confused with the Iroquois people like the Mohawks. They're a completely different indigenous people. Their language, their culture are different from Lenape, but my work is indeed to come back and make a reconnection, a spiritual reconnection. Reclamation is a word, but I must say that we never voluntarily ceded our lands to the Europeans, but I'm returning through this work and the work of Lenape Center to to reclaim our place as occupants in the homeland. And it's very rewarding and very empowering.
What do you want folks to take away from this? Not just a, you know, an opening of a festival, but all of the things that you're trying to impart upon folks that are attending?
Well, it's a literary festival, so there's going to be a lot of published books to compete with people to get people's attention. But in this opening session, and I do appreciate being placed on the front end of the three-day agenda, the session is to inform people, many of whom don't realize that there are still Lenape people around, that are living, breathing descendants of the original people. By the way, I will promote my session 7 o'clock this Friday. Tickets are $15, and the first 100 people that buy a ticket will get a copy of the Lenape Hoking anthology as part of their experience. So they'll be able to read and view the contents, which includes historical essays, artwork, poetry, and a pretty wide array of representation of the descendants of the original people. And I think the story and the richness of our culture and the depth of cultural expressions will be quite appealing to these folks. I don't think you'll find another book similar at all when they show up at the festival this weekend.
I know that at the Lenape Center, you're not only teaching folks about the history of the tribe of the Lenape, but also working toward the creation of a cultural center, something a little bit more permanent. How is that going?
It's going slow, but steady. And a lot of it has to do with, again, elevating the presence of our organization, which is an extension of elevating the presence of the Lenape people. Most of whom reside in these other states that I talked about. The center itself, our designs for a center are a cultural center to express our culture, but also a welcoming center for the Lenape people to come back to the homeland and have a place where they feel welcome, they feel attached to it. But it's going slow because we would like for it to be based in Manhattan. And as you know, real estate in Manhattan is pretty expensive, so we continue to be engaged in a fundraising effort to achieve that. We've been very successful, however, in building partnerships with museums, libraries, universities, and other institutions already in New York City that host us and provide space for us. And these partnerships are really important in our future efforts to finally acquire some land or a building that we can turn into a physical Lenape Center.
That's Curtis Siniga, who's opening the Deepwater Literary Festival Friday at 7 at the Tustin Theater in Narrowsburg. Ticket information at deepwaterfestival.com. And you can find out more about the Lenape Center at lenape.center. Curtis, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to you opening the festival Friday.
Great. Wonderful to talk with you. Appreciate this opportunity to invite people to come out and see you this Friday at 7 p.m. at the festival.
And coming up on Sunday at the Deepwater Literary Festival at 2, it's Creative Process, Crafting the Memoir. Go inside the creative process and deep into the craft of memoir with three contemporary memoirists at the three stages of their writing projects. Melise Galula is founder of Memoiring, and she'll be joined by Haesung Song, author of Docile, Memoirs of a Not-So-Perfect Asian Girl, that's coming out next month, and Joseph Earl Thomas, author of Sink, a memoir, which was longlisted for the Penn Gene Stein Book Award. Joining us now for a preview, two of those memoirists from the panel, Melissa Galula and Haesung Song. Good morning to both of you.
Hi there.
Hi, thanks for being here. So crafting a memoir, it might sound daunting or challenging, and part of what this panel is about and this discussion is about is some of the challenges and mistakes along the way. I want to ask both of you, what are some of the significant challenges of crafting a memoir? Melise, do you want to go first?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think like the internet is filled with the significant challenges of crafting a memoir. And so many people want to, you know, tell their story or have something, you know, they've shared at a dinner party and people say, you should write about that. I think what's really challenging though is realizing that something we would put into a journal is very different than something that we would put out there in a book published for public consumption. We have to turn our lives into a story, and that is art. And I feel like that is one of the biggest challenges, learning those skills that writers spend a lot of time learning how to do that. So even coming from journalism, I didn't know character development, right? You need a character on the page, yourself even. You have to turn yourself into a character. So not just being a narrator who reports on what's happened around her or to her, but conveying, you know, a 360 rich character that people fall in love with and are rooting for.
Hey, Sung, I mentioned the memoir, Docile Memoirs of a Not-So-Perfect Asian Girl, coming out next month. Was that one of the challenges, making yourself a character in this memoir?
Absolutely. I think beyond just like the craft work, something that I had a really hard time with for a long time, which was difficult and without timeline, was the emotional work. Everything that goes into healing yourself enough to tease the meaning out of the events of your life so you can figure out what the story actually is. Memoirists like to say, write from the scar, not the wound. And I think, like Melise just said, the emotional work is a major difference between having, on the one hand, a bunch of journal entries on the end versus a crafted, developed story, which is art, on the other.
So I want to talk to you a little bit more about this memoir. And you know, it is, as you said, making it from the scar, not the wound. How can you tell folks about sort of the arc of the story that you're telling in your memoir?
Yeah. Docile Memoirs of a Not-So-Perfect Asian Girl was actually written over the course of about 20 years. It finally comes out in July 16 with Simon & Schuster, and it's a coming-of-age memoir about growing up as a first-generation Korean-American in Texas in a family that's not exactly the model minority stereotype. Most relevantly, my father is absolutely obsessed with becoming a billionaire. We end up going bankrupt. We lose our house. We move to the wrong side of a white and wealthy neighborhood in Texas. And to hide the ways in which my family is not so model, I become a great student, which works for a while. I end up going to the Ivy League. I study at Princeton and Harvard Law School and Harvard Graduate School until one morning I wake up in a psychiatric hospital having survived a suicide attempt. The main twist is in the hospital, I decide I must heal and choose myself. So I end up leaving the hospital, leaving Harvard, disappointing my parents, and I moved to New York City, where I become an artist, finding unconditional self-expression in art. Docile is my journey to form this identity outside the conception of the model minority myth, heal from mental illness, and find redemption in art.
It's a memoir, but as you describe it, it's almost like you are describing this character. Is that part of like the process, I suppose, and just being able to tell this story in this format?
Yes, actually, I read a lot of memoirs over the course of writing this book, but I also read a lot of novels. And one of the biggest compliments that I've received about Docile is just that it's kind of a page turner. And I took a lot of inspiration from novels because of just what Melise was saying before about character development, thinking about oneself as a character in a novel.
Melise, you're currently writing your memoir, which is about being raised by a child psychologist who starts to hear voices. What stage are you in? Haesung just said that it took about 20 years to get hers out next month. Finally, where are you in this process?
I'm probably then at the halfway mark, at 10 years. I'm not too shy of that. In some ways, I mean, I decided I would start writing this project about my mother and myself when I was, 2017. And, you know, I didn't know how seriously to take it. I don't know that I would have called it a memoir then, but it was really important for me to start thinking about my mother's story, and maybe because she'd passed away. So I have been working on it for some time now, and that meant, you know, pulling scenes from my childhood through a pattern that would make sense in a novel, just like Heisman was saying, right? Like, as telling a story that one domino leads to another. And that's been my process. I don't know, maybe I'm 3/4 of the way done. Maybe it's the messy middle. I don't know. I just finished my MFA in creative nonfiction, and that was a wonderful opportunity to really polish a big chunk of my book. So, you know, there's a big chunk that needs some polishing to go. But I'm really excited for people to be talking about memoir more, the process of it, but also the popularity of it. I think that so many people would love to know what memoirs other people are reading, and the buzzy big book clubs don't have that many memoir on them every year. You know, I'm the one who's like kind of waiting for like Jenna Bush Hager to announce, you know, a memoir, and they're, you know, great novels. I'm reading them all, but I'm kind of memoir obsessed. So I'm really excited that more people are turning out to hear about what memoirs are popular and picking them up at their library and coming to the Deep Water to hear panelists and authors talk about memoir.
Was that the motivation behind memoiring, which is a writing community that hosts memoirists? And it's also difficult for someone like me to say, but it's a book club that is also a community, right? Can you tell us more about it?
Yes, sure. You know, that was sort of the inspiration. I think, you know, one of the things they tell writers that you should read, you know, ravenously in the genre that you're writing in, like Heisman said, she's read a ton of memoirs. So was I. But even in my MFA program, I think they were shy to give us recommendations of like, or not recommendations. They would give those, but they wouldn't give assignments. We're reading this book this week. We're reading this book next week, because there's so much writing. So what I found was I wanted to be in a community of people who were talking about memoirs in the way that we tend to just talk about fiction. So memoiring is a little hard to say. It's a free book club. We meet on Zoom once a month to discuss the books that have been selected and announced on Substack or Instagram. And what we also do is we meet with the author of the book. So we're reading it, and then we're chatting for an hour, often with the author. And because there are so many folks who are interested in writing their own memoir too, often we have the authors offer a mini craft class too on something like tangible, a writing prompt. So we've really become a writing community, and we help authors break into the market too with their debut book. So it's something I'm just really passionate about, and it's been an incredible process. And like I said, it's free. So all you have to do is join us on Substack and, you know, attend when we do the Zooms. And it's been fabulous so far. We started in September and going strong 10, 11 months later.
Mm-hmm. We were talking to both of you about your memoirs and the transformation of your families into characters. And Heisman, you mentioned your dad being obsessed with becoming a billionaire. Malise, you mentioned, you know, some of the things that your mother had been going through in terms of perhaps hearing voices as a child psychologist. You know, when you think about this, we all have something or someone like this in our family. Is it about sort of, when you're creating this memoir, sort of narrowing in? And I think it was maybe Malise, you had said, you know, reflecting back and finding those scenes, is that part of this transformation of like the family and that dynamic into a character?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, I'll let Heisman speak to this too, but I really had, it's funny, your writing instructors will always say, you know, write like nobody's going to read what you're writing. Write like everybody is dead that you're writing about. And it does in some way free you up if the person who you're writing about has passed on. It lets you sort of be more honest, and you might have a harder time doing that and negotiating your relationship with somebody who might not like the truth published. And of course, we all have our truths, and a lot of people, you know, show their parents or their ex-husbands, you know, the memoir beforehand, but plenty of people choose not to do that. So it is a particular thing. It is choosing the scenes too that will deliver a through line for your book, and not having extraneous material in it that doesn't make sense to your story. But I'd love to hear how Heisman navigated that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the ethics issue is so specific, obviously, to the memoir genre. It's a true account of one's life. So how do you not navigate the ethics of writing about others when your life is obviously populated by other people? When I first started writing when I was in college, what would be the first chapters of Docil, I was just writing for myself because I was curious about this family that I had grown up in that had provided so much imprinting and so much of a pattern about the world, but I really didn't understand them. And I knew in order to understand myself, I would have to understand them. So I was just writing and writing and writing. And I experienced the most fascinating gift, which was just that writing can help you make sense of the world. But I agree with Melise in that when you first start writing, you don't even know where you're going. You have a sense of something and you're following it like a bloodhound. And it's the development of an idea. It's the development of an understanding.
So many layers and so much to talk about in just an hour on Sunday at the Creative Process Crafting a Memoir panel. What is it you hope folks are able to take away from this session on Sunday? Hey, Sung.
I'm so excited to be on this panel, Tim, because and participate as a presenter in this festival, which I've attended for years. I want to talk a little bit about Docil, but also provide encouragement by sharing my own story, but my own story of writing my memoir over a long period of time, because I think there are a lot of people out there who need encouragement because they want to tell their own stories. You know, to encourage them to have curiosity about themselves and puzzle things out. Sometimes you need a little experience, a little bit more of life before you can see the way through the whole piece, and just to be patient, but also actively working. And that's the kind of thing that I want to connect with the audience about on Sunday.
Melise?
Oh my gosh, I love what she just said. I don't know if I can add to that, except that I have found that, you know, some of the most fascinating details in memoir are the decisions that authors have to make about writing them. And just like we're talking about it today. And so this will be a conversation where there'll be a little bit of that backstage access to what goes on in an author's mind and relationships and the time period it took them, and what they figured out about themselves that maybe they didn't know when they started the project, and then what the publishing process was like, whether that be 5, 10, you know, 20 years later. I think all of that is just amazing and fascinating, and I think people are going to be really excited.
It's going to be a candid conversation about this journey from idea to the draft of a book to publication beyond, and just, you know, the whole process. So thank you guys for doing this. And again, you're joined by Joseph Earl Thomas, author of Sink, a memoir. That's Sunday at 2 at the Deepwater Literary Festival. This conversation taking place at the 108, that's at 108 Main Street in Narrowsburg. There's more information about this event presented in association with Radio Catskill and Memoiring at deepwaterfestival.com. More information about memoiring at memoiring.substack.com. And more information about Haesung Song at haesungsong.com. Thank you both for joining us this morning to give us a preview. I'm excited by this and look forward to seeing you Sunday at the Deepwater Literary Festival.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's been awesome.
All right. That's going to do it for us here this morning on Radio Chatskill. A reminder, we are participating with StoryCorps in One Small Step. That is an effort to remind everyone of the humanity in all of us, even those with whom we disagree. It's an initiative bringing strangers together to have a conversation. You can learn more about this effort with StoryCorps called One Small Step at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Radio Catskill supporters include SUNY Sullivan, a community college in the Sullivan Catskills focused on preparing students for the future. More information at sunysullivan.edu. Livingston Manor, dining, shopping, and the arts at the gateway to the Catskill Park. LivingstonManorNY.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hey everybody, this is Jeff Loeffler of The Deep End, and you can join me each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight as I explore the deep end of the catalogs of bands maybe you know, maybe you don't know. You'll hear some Rolling Stones, Grateful Dead, Government Mule, right alongside bands like The Electric Peanut Butter Conspiracy, Kula Shaker, and Supergrass. That's The Deep End each and every Friday night from 10 to midnight right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. The heat advisory has been extended by the National Weather Service until tomorrow at 8 o'clock. Today, expect more hot and humid conditions, an afternoon thunderstorm. Stay cool and well hydrated. A reminder that some of these storms that pop up can bring small hail and damaging winds. 86 in Liberty with a real feel heat index of 98. It's 11 o'clock.